Hello, everybody. Happy New Year. Welcome back to the Ring of Honor Retrocast, where we go back in time and reminisce about the noteworthy, the glorious, the unique, or the bizarre shows in the history of Ring of Honor past. Over here on PWPodcast.com. We're going to cover what was going on in Ring of Honor at a time, give our thoughts on the matches then and now, and have a whole bunch of good discussion in the process. I can't do it alone, so let me introduce you to my fellow time travelers for the episode of the show. First, we have my co-host from Podcast of Honor and an admin of the We Love Pro Wrestling Facebook group, Chris GST. How are you, GST?
I'm doing good, Ari. Doing good. Can't complain too much about my weather.
Yes, over there in Cali, a very nice... actually, I have no idea how it is out there. How is it out there?
It's slightly cold, but I don't think I can complain. I do, however, have two cough drops going on right now, so we'll see how long my throat holds out.
All right, well, let's hope it holds out. And also joining me, my fellow Brooklynite, and also an admin of the We Love Pro Wrestling Facebook group. What a coincidence. Chris McGill. McGill, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Ari. Good to talk to you again.
All right. So with the introductions out of the way, let's get into our choice for this episode. It's been a while, but we're going to go all Scott Bakula and Quantum Leap to September 16, 2006. And I think that's an appropriate phrasing because we were actually at this. Well, Chris and I, we were there live in the row, so we're going to quantum leap back into our own bodies from 7 years ago. Glory by Honor 5, Night 2. Yes, 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 it's Brian Danielson, now known as Daniel Bryan, and he's in the middle of the show and about to hit the one-year anniversary mark of his Ring of Honor world title run, scheduled to defend against Pro Wrestling Noah's Wonderkind Kenta. And I guess the first thing we should talk about before getting into the matches is the importance of the show. This was ROH's debut in the Grand Ballroom, the upstairs part of the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York City, which is about a block and a half away from Madison Square Garden. And right around the corner from the New Yorker Hotel is where Ring of Honor held its first three shows in New York City. And this is the first ever show in the Grand Ballroom and basically has ever since been host to some of their best shows. And, you know, obviously, like I just said, they were at the New Yorker. They did a show at the Supper Club for the ECW One Night Stand weekend. And they also did a couple shows at Basketball City, a.k.a. Death Trap City, because there was only one entrance and exit at any given time. But let's just go to Mikio, since he was there with me in many of these New York shows. Why was getting to the Hammerstein so important at the time for Ring of Honor?
Because it kind of offered a larger spaced venue that had a more of a traditional feel for a wrestling show. For those people who know the Grand Ballroom, it is where the original Monday Night Raw episodes came out of. So that kind of had a little bit of a connection to the past of the wrestling business. And just in the fact that it was, like you said, a block and a half away from Madison Square Garden, it kind of became like the opportunity for ROH to have their own sort of mecca, if you will, in New York City, which had become a really hot market for the product.
Yeah, I think it was sort of throwing the gauntlet down. I mean, also, New York, they had done the New Yorker, like I said, right around the corner, and it was really notable for like being super intense, like these crowds. It was a small, confined place.
Super intense because the spacing was just so tight. I mean, if you didn't really want to get to know somebody really well that you didn't know before, going to a show at the New Yorker was definitely not for you.
Yeah, and I think that was, I mean, the Joe Kobashi show, it just sort of was like the point where you thought like, oh man, it's really cool to be here. It's so great, such a great vibe. But at the same time, it was just overstuffed with people that they needed someplace else to go. And so they did a couple different shows, like I said, and then they went back to the Grand Ballroom, or went to the Grand Ballroom for the first time, and it was a bigger venue, opened up a little bit more, but you know, nonetheless, still had this kind of the intensity and just crowd volume, and again, things were at a really big peak at the time for Wander in terms of the storylines, in terms of the star power, what was going on. So it was huge, unique venue at the time, and definitely interesting to go to these shows. We went to all these shows, Akio. So
absolutely.
I wasn't going to be in the front row of the first show, and then obviously watching ourselves on DVD. It was really funny just to watch my reactions and your reactions, and I definitely took notes on what we were doing.
The thing that I remembered, like when I first popped it in, I was watching it. We took my cousin to that show, and that was his first and only ROH event. And he was sitting between you and I, and it was like just watching his, you know, kind of catching back and watching his reactions as someone who wasn't, you know, an ROH fan or has always just been a kind of casual here and there watcher of wrestling, to watch him kind of pop for a lot of the stuff that we would normally just, you know, that we'd seen before. I thought was really great to go back and see that on the DVD.
Yeah, I agree, and it's something. It's interesting because we took a lot of people to shows at the time, and just going to Final Battle 2013 in December, I took my cousin Jay. It's the second time he went to a Ring of Honor show, and he had a really good time. We were sitting behind, sitting in front of a couple who were going to their first Ring of Honor show, and hearing them react. And again, it's you know, again, 7 years later, and I think the Hammerstein, even though it's the downstairs part now and not so much the upstairs, it still retains a little bit of that kind of character to it. GST.
The upstairs room, though, there's something special about that upstairs room. I don't know what it is. It's like, because we, you know, we've been in both the big room and the small room upstairs, but the upstairs just has a much better vibe. It's like, even though it's bigger than like other spaces that ROH typically runs, it still had that level of intimacy. I think it was because maybe the we used to sit in the balcony a lot. That was like that was the last show I believe we sat ringside for, and then we transferred to sitting up in the front row balcony. And when you sat in that front row balcony in the upstairs room, it was like it was the most perfect view of watching a wrestling show.
Literally, it's like, you know, before 3D was, you know, really back in the fold in terms of movies. Yeah. With these guys flying at you, it really did seem like 3D.
That grand ballroom room. I you'll never hear me say a bad word about it.
Yep. JST, any thoughts on Ring of Honor in New York City? I know, obviously, being in California, you know, the Ring of Honor is run seldomly there, but. You were definitely following and running the Live Journal blog at the time. What did you think about them really moving into the New York venues, what they had done to that point, and what sort of the Hammerstein Ballroom meant for them at that point?
Pretty much very similar thoughts in that it was a big step for them moving forward. The New York crowd, obviously always really good for Ring of Honor, but there's something about that Manhattan Center, the history involved with it, that probably to the fans watching at the time gave them a little bit more of an oomph for Ring of Honor. You know, it's one thing to say that you run really big armories and have lots of fans in the area, but it's another thing to be in an historic building. There's something to that. And Ring of Honor to that point they established themselves, but in terms of wrestling history and wrestling lore, this was a big step for them. And obviously Bruno Sammartino being there that night was really important as well. For everything else, it really felt, you know, being out here in California, that even though I understood what this meant for Ring of Honor, I just felt that it was kind of a, almost like an achievement for them. Like them saying, here we are, we're finally at a place where we can tout, this is where a lot of wrestling history has taken place, and now we're here, we're a part of it. And they were doing some really great stuff at the time. So, I mean, I think many people would argue that 2006 was definitely one of their best years. So I was really happy for them. Of course, I didn't quite understand the significance, having never been to the venue to that point, but I understood what it meant. So I thought this was a really big step for Ring of Honor.
Right. And then you were here just this past year for the WrestleMania weekend. So you weren't actually in the upstairs portion, but you were in the downstairs portion of the Hammerstein, which is obviously the bigger, the more well-known built part of the building where ECW used to run, the original ECW used to run shows, and when WWE did their ECW one-night stand shows, they did those there. So there's a substantial amount of history right in that, you know, on the corner of 34th and 8th in New York City. So very interesting stuff. Also, let's talk about Bryan Danielson's, I don't know if we should call him Bryan Danielson or Daniel Bryan during this show. It's always kind of
I'm so used to calling him Daniel Bryan at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, it might as well. And most of our listeners may even know him as Daniel Bryan at this point. And even if not,
right.
we're just so used to it. Might as well.
Right. All right. So Daniel Bryan is 1 year on as Ring of Honor world champion at this point, having won it a year, obviously, just because I just said that, at Glory by Honor 4 against James Gibson. He was faced for a couple months, turned heel, supported Ring of Honor in the CZW war for his own selfish reasons, and was a heel against Samoa Joe, unified the World and Pure title against Nigel McGuinness to bring the two titles together in the summer of that year, but also suffered a shoulder injury, which was, I believe, torn tendons in the one-hour draw he had with Cabana in Chicago during the summer of 2006. So a lot of stuff going on with Bryan Danielson at that time. Also, a lot of the things he did in the ring, a lot of the sayings he developed were important to his character at that time. So GST, what did you think about Danielson's run at that point? What did you enjoy about it? And what sticks out to you about it now many years later?
It was just one of those defining runs for Ring of Honor. Of course, I think everyone knew about Samoa Joe's run at the time, and almost every champion after him was kind of measured up, and unfairly or fairly, depending on your point of view. But Daniel Bryan at this point, he really was the face of Ring of Honor. And I think deservedly so. He'd put on some of the best matches. He'd been there since the first show. So for him not to hold up to the standard of Samoa Joe, I thought, would have been slightly disappointing as a fan. But I mean, he proved me wrong, I guess. And not that I expected anything less from him, but he was really holding up. Of course, it being a year and seeing some, I believe within that year period, he'd actually defended the title more than Joe had in his first year. I'm not entirely sure on that, so don't quote me on it, but I'm pretty sure they were touting that he had, you know, the most title defenses within a given period of time. And clearly, he was beaten up. I think there was a lot of concern, especially not particularly this match per se, but this time period in his profession, that when he did come to WWE, a lot of people were like, oh man, he's already beat up a bit. But I think it was matches like this that he was having that showed, hey, you know what, he'll grit it out and he'll still give you a stellar match. I think that a lot of fans saw Daniel Bryan as probably a man who could not have a bad match, you know? And, of course, his feud with Nigel McGuinness, to me, has to be in the top five feuds in Ring of Honor history. That's just my opinion, but with all the matches, you know, like at Unified and all the matches previous, I mean, the wrestling is just so good. I would defy anyone to find any other series of matches that had the quality and level of two technicians going at it the way they did during this time. Other than that, it's, you know, kind of hit and miss, kind of like with Samoa Joe's. You know, he had some title defenses against guys, you know, like Delirious or, you know, guys you pretty much knew were not going to win the title from him, but he still was able to get a hell of a match out of them. So at this point in Ring of Honor, he was the right champion for the right time, and I think he'll always be remembered for it. And while the belt already had a lot of prestige, I think he took it to another level with some of the, I guess you could say, ring tacticianship of, and that's a totally made up word, but just flow with me here, you know, because Samoa Joe was the brawler, Austin Aries, kind of, you know, the hybrid wrestler, and of course we had CM Punk, Jamie Noble, James Gibson, but we'd never had a world champion who was just straight up technical wrestler, and I think that's what Daniel Bryan brought.
Mikio, same question.
I think Chris really did hit it on the head that, you know, everybody will always remember, like, real ROH people will always remember the Joe, you know, 22-month reign as, like, you know, the title run. The only one that I think you can really put up against it is the Danielson one, and or Daniel Bryan thing. I every once in a while I shift in and out of the name, so I'm sorry about that. You know, it's like we were at the show when he won the title from Gibson also. And I remember right. what the reaction to his return was at that point, because we didn't know he was going to be there for that show. And when he won the title, it was just like the persona that he had at that point was, you know, the returning hero, and the fans were all crazy. And then I remember watching over the years, seeing the asshole-ish tendencies start to develop in the character. and they were done in such a subtle way that it was like you couldn't really just say, oh, here's his turn point, or he went, you know, he turned here. And it was just so much fun. It was just such subtle, like, you know, I'm the best. I don't care if you think I'm a jerk. This is how I do business. If you don't like it, you know, screw you. And it was just such an enjoyable kind of action that he had kind of portrayed through that whole year. His in-ring was phenomenal. And it's just like I remember we did start to worry about, you know, his health after we'd seen like all these things like start to pile up. And then it just got worse, you know, down the line with the stuff with him and Morishima. His reign, that title reign, was just so awesome. And like Chris said, you know, like so technical. It's like he made guys who, you know, were borderline guys who did get the shots, even like Chris said, you didn't know, you knew they weren't going to win. He made them look like $1 million. And that's, you know, that's what your top guys really should do. Your top guys should make, you know, other guys look like $1 million. And he really did that for them at that point. And I just remember the anticipation that we had going to that show that night to see him and Kenta. I mean, they'd had some matches before, but it was just, you thought maybe something could happen because we all knew that Kenta was going to be booked for a bunch of shows that fall. So we thought maybe something like that could happen, but you just knew you were going to get a match that was going to just, like, you know, knock the wind right out of you as you watched it. So you knew what you were getting from Danielson and what you were getting from him every night. And it's just, I guess it's almost the same as what you get from him every time he wrestles now. You know you're going to get, you know, a great show from a great performer.
Were you guys at the next Glory Bonner? Glory Bonner 6, obviously. Were you guys there when he went up? And pretty much, you know, he was still kind of, you know, returning hero against Morishima, but then Nigel was champion at the time. Did you guys?
I guess the best way to look at it like this is that in that period of time, Ari and I were at every ROH show in New York City except for, what was the one we missed because it was your mom's birthday?
It was A New Level.
Yeah, that's the only one we missed between, like, what, 2004 and, like, 2012?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, because it's funny, when you were talking about it, because I watched 5, and then just for the heck of it, I watched 6, and I was like, you could really see the correlation. In a year span, Nigel McGuinness became the Ring of Honor champion, and in my opinion, at Glory of Honor 6, he also started showing signs of turning, because, you know, the fans were still chanting, you know, boo, you can't defend the title because you're hurt. And he cuts this promo, and the fans are just crapping on him. And I was like, it's so similar what was happening with Bryan Danielson in the sense that he was champion, and he was just telling fans how it was, being honest, and it's almost like the subtlety was he was turning heel, but he kind of wasn't. He was still the same guy having these great matches. He was just kind of now in your face about it.
So with Bryan Danielson, it was more, you know, I'm still going to wrestle with the injury. And then he wrestled all the way through December of 2006 and then took time off for the rehab, which I think he talked about a lot of that, you know, that injury, actually in his interview with Steve Austin. That's a couple shows a couple weeks ago. And he says that the shoulder injury wasn't as bad as the orbital bone injury that he got from Morishima a year later. But with McGuinness, I mean, it was obvious he shouldn't have been in the ring. And we were at Glory of Honor 6 Night 2, where all that controversy happened. And definitely an interesting change. I mean, I think that also goes to the point of the changing New York crowds and what they wanted. Because, you know, the New York crowds always wanted to put effort in. But I think there was, as the years went on, a little bit of a lack of, an increasing lack of empathy. Something switched. Something happened.
All I'm hearing is that it's all your fault that these guys are injured. That's basically what I just heard.
It is my fault.
Yeah. Shame.
As far as Kenta goes, Chris Vecchio put up a great point. Kenta had become a known factor in Ring of Honor. He teamed up with Mara Fuji, who was also on this show, at the Best in the World, the first Best in the World event, which was in March 2006. At Basketball City in New York City as part of the Milestone Series. And Danielson and Samoa Joe had teamed up at that point, and they were on really good terms. So, you know, the whole idea of Danielson, I think, was really mostly a heel towards Samoa Joe. And a guy to lose some weight, you know, is kind of a heel dick move. So I could definitely see that the heel tendencies there. And then stuff like saying, I have until five, really obviously, then you're going to get your effing head kicked in, telling it to the fans where I think Danielson did tell it to the fans where, especially the CZW fans, that they got on his case and he gave it right back to them. And I think that actually made him face to the Ring of Honor fans who attended shows at that point in the summer of 2006. So there you go, a little bit of Danielson in a small nutshell, his title run. Let's quickly mention a few storyline items going on during this time, and then we'll get to the show. This was in the middle of the Road of Honor fallout of the Honor CZW war, and that resulted in Jim Cornette turning heel as an authority figure in the company years before he actually has pretty much turned heel for legit for many Ring of Honor fans. And the likes of Adam Pearce and the Briscoes were siding with him. Also turning heel. CZW guys who were on the losing end of the battle were kind of gone, but that didn't mean the end of the story for Chris Hero and Claudio Castagnoli, aka Antonio Cesaro, who betrayed Ring of Honor to join up with the Kings of Wrestling, or as the Kings of Wrestling, and take on the cause of winning the Ring of Honor tag team titles. And the Kings Wrestling actually stole Generation X tag team belts. Generation X was Austin Aries and Roderick Strong as a duo, and they were on a 9-month title run. And they stole the belts and entered an open contract challenge to receive the title shot on this show. And elsewhere, Jimmy Jacobs was still chasing Lacey, but Lacey was all about Colt's Cabana. You know what I'm saying? What am I saying? Colt had stooped Lacey, and Jacobs was depressed as a result. And some guy named Bruno Sammartino or whatever was slated to make a special appearance on the show. Whoever that guy is, I'm not sure.
Just before we get started, can you imagine this? This, to me, was the definitive Ring of Honor roster. You had guys like Colt Cabana, Davey Richards, still obviously with them, and then you had Jimmy Jacobs, the Briscoes, Samoa Joe, Daniel Bryan, Homicide. Just, this was the best Ring of Honor roster, in my opinion, at any point.
Yeah,
And then you had
there's
obviously
no
Nigel and
question.
Daniel Bryan at the top. I think that's kind of a
Yeah.
point that should be pointed out, because not saying anything against the current Ring of Honor roster, but I think for a lot of fans, this was that perfect time when Ring of Honor was just breaking out on all cylinders
Yeah.
when it came to the talents.
Yeah. The 2005 to 2007 roster was the best.
Just crazy.
I kind of have a hard time arguing that point. Yeah, I mean, you look at any show and it's just top to bottom filled with guys who are great or contributed in their own way or have made it onto bigger and better things. So I can't argue the point. I think definitely in years later you had very good talents but as a whole, top to bottom, yeah, this was a peak era, like the golden age of Ring of Honor, even before TV had come in. So let's get to the show. Let's talk about what happened on the show itself. Bryan Danielson cuts a promo talking about Madison Square Garden, and he walks on the streets of New York City down to the outside of the building of the Hammerstein Ballroom, and he says, "This is the building where I make my legacy." And there's a nice little promo package that the Ring of Honor guys were starting to include on these shows to build up the big main events, and there are highlights shown of Danielson's title defense and Kenta's appearances that we talked about from 2005 to 2006 to sort of build up to this match is something very epic. Dave Prezak and Ara David are on commentary, and we start with smiling and happy David Richards versus Jack Evans in as Jack Evans did a Battle of Washingtonians. And very interesting to see Richards going from opener in New York City to main event headliner just several years later. And he has the Running with the Devil theme song, which back for Ring of Honor had to change from actual music to, or I mean, they still use actual music, but more pop music in the pop culture versus sort of a more generic, lesser known theme versions. And I mean, Running with the Devil is just amazing. Like if that's one of the first songs you hear on a show like this, you're gonna be popped and ready for it. Evans definitely over huge, and not just with the female fan who used to shriek Jack
Oh boy.
Evans, his name, all match
Oh
long.
boy.
No, he was huge all over, man. And he was
But
big. He was
she was sitting
big.
right next to us that night too. So it was
Was she
bad.
really? Oh
Yeah.
wow.
Yeah.
Oh
Yeah.
man.
Oh, what an experience that is, Chris. Let me GSC, let me tell you. The match is short, 7 minutes, but pretty action-packed. And basically, there's a lot of spot foo from Jack Evans, and then it catches up with him, and Richard just tosses him around for major damage. In fact, I think he did it right in front of Chris and all of
Yes, he
us.
did.
And and basically, just seeing our reactions, like, Richard's just killing Jack. Do you think Mikio was like telling Richards to kill him and
I
just
did.
really.
I think I did tell him to please kill him. I wanted
Yes.
that woman to shut up, so I figured if he killed him, she would shut up.
And she didn't.
There's nothing better than a really stacked guy just beating up a scrawny high flyer. I mean, there really isn't for any crowd. I think that's just the perfect moment. So.
But Evans recovers with a space flying fucking tiger drop with a corkscrew and a 630 attempt, but Richards gets the knees up and it really looked well, very well done. He gets cutting card for two, not avoiding any Davey Boy Smith comparisons. Stretch muffler to the ropes. Evans is able to break it off. Does this really crazy running flying Hurricanrana for a close two. Richards has the arm Clark throw up and kick at this point, which is interesting. A little bit of, he's not used a lot of the offense he used in this match in the future. Like, there's definite difference between, PWG Ring of Honor 2006 Davey Richards is what he does now in the ring, but he definitely has kept a few things here and there. And like the stretch muffler, for instance, I don't think he uses that at all these days. And he gets
Yeah,
it.
I was shocked when I saw it again. I was like, whoa, I don't remember him even doing this.
Yeah, it was something Antonio Cesaro used, I think, a lot also around that, well, maybe a year earlier or so.
He probably
He
just
used
decided
that to
the
cut the
ankle
crowd.
lock was a lot easier. He's like, you know what? Let's just do the ankle lock because I'm like Kurt Angle,
See
but small.
if I put this guy on my head and twist it here. I just did that. So it's a 7 minute rock and roller. The crowd was awesome for it. Chris GST, thoughts about this match?
That was a perfect opener, I thought. I mean, the New York crowd, you guys went crazy for this. And like I said, I think there is nothing better to open a crowd than just a really obviously well-built dude beating up a smaller guy. And Jack Evans, I mean, he's obviously very talented, but sometimes you just want to see guys like that get beat up. I don't know why. It's primal. It's something there. But I thought this was a really fun match. Good stuff from both. And I think it set the tone for the rest of the night.
Thank you.
Yeah, I kind of Chris really kind of said what needed to be said. The thing that I liked that they I remember it from I remember from the time is that they were pushing Davey as Kenta's American protege, and it was sort of like trying to give him like a little bit more of a rub by putting him in the corner of a guy who was a lot more popular and a lot more known, which was kind of interesting. Like Chris said though, it's like it was fun to watch Davey Richards just beat the living bejesus out of Jack Evans. I've never been a huge Jack Evans guy. It's like his offense to me always just seemed like all it was flipping and flopping, and it was just like, come on, man, at least do something. But yeah, it was good. It was a good match.
Something. He did the space fucking flying tiger.
To me, it none of his stuff ever seemed like it was like gonna really be enough to put somebody down.
No, I got you. I got you.
And it was just
I
like
agree.
whenever he would try to throw strikes, they looked shitty. If it was throwing a punch or he was trying to throw a kick, his kick, it's like he would do a flip kick, but it was like more of a flip than a kick. And it was just like, that's at that point when Davey was starting to be a little bit more stiff with his work in the ring, it was you're starting to say to yourself, it's like, that's what I want to see. And it was like the Jack Evans, I think that
And
was
then
around
doing
the
this
time
all.
when guy when a guy like Jack kind of maybe started to see his way, out of the picture, if you will.
Fair
And
enough, fair enough.
it was becoming a much more physical product, all from top to bottom, and that maybe a guy who didn't do that kind of physical stuff was not going to really have a place anymore on the ROH show.
I think Jack still stuck around for a couple of years, but it was sort of the back end of his career, and he really took a while to get to the Vulture squad and all that kind of stuff. So I agree. I agree with that point. Next up is the honor ceremony for Bruno Sammartino. Kind of a really cool thing. Bruno was really out of the spotlight for a long time, and obviously for Ring of Honor to get him to come in to a wrestling show, especially one right next to Madison Square Garden where he did these shows and It was very special. But basically, you got a speech from Bruno Sammartino with the entire roster and even the Japanese contingent that were there with Kenta and Marufuji, and that included Takeshi Morishima and Muhammad Hirone, who were there sort of like a support for the other Japanese guys. So Cruz gave him a very nice introduction, and the crowd obviously loved him, gave a great ovation. Bruno was very humble. He basically said most of you were in diapers by the time I retired, essentially saying, the crowd probably didn't see, most of the crowd did not see him in his prime, but could still appreciate him nonetheless. So nice short speech. It's great to see Bruno here, but really this is about the angle with Samoa Joe and Morishima as everybody exits. Each is trying to give each other the way to leave, but they get frustrated with each other quickly, and there's pushing and shoving. Joe gets in the ring and eggs Morishima on, and the crowd is just going berserk at these two big bruisers going at it. It takes the entire Ring of Honor roster room to separate from the celebration and get these two and get them out. And just a crazy pull apart. Christopher Daniels, interestingly seen reasoning with Morishima. Chance of Joe. The actual match between these two would have to wait for the 5th anniversary festival. Mikio, were you as pumped as I was when Joe and Morishima went to blows during this segment? And what were your thoughts about Bruto's appearance?
Totally. I was hoping that, something was going to happen that night. You got the feeling that, maybe that was not going to just be a little pull apart, in that segment, but that maybe Morishima would come back out later on, or maybe, you figured something was going to happen. I just didn't think it would take that long as it did. Coolest thing, when I was watching the DVD, when you were talking about the pull apart, as it was with the whole roster coming out, if you notice, Larry Dallas is actually one of the guys trying to pull him apart when he was still, I guess, a student with the ROH school. And he was one of the guys trying to hold Joe back. And it was like, wait a minute.
That's not going to work.
Say it again?
I said, that's not going to work.
No, Larry Dallas is a good manager, but he's not holding Joe back. But it was, the thing was, it's like, I remembered how cool it was to see Sammartino like up close and in person. It seemed like, it's like, I didn't really watch the whole speech when I watched the DVD again. It seemed like it went on. It seemed like it wasn't short. It seemed like it was a pretty long talk. So It was good to see him up close, and I remember the fans were very respectful, and everybody was really into seeing him there. But that was the case for any legends who showed up at ROH New York shows. I mean, there were a couple other guys who showed up. I mean, Ric Flair showed up, Bret Hart showed up, at different times in the future or the past of Ring of Honor, and the New York fans are always very respectful of these guys who do return.
There's been plenty of guest stars, even going back to the beginning, like in 2002 when Tommy Dreamer came in, and a lot of guys that people would look at a list today and go, really, these guys were appearing in Ring of Honor before Ring of Honor even got its name or was super on television or anything like that. And yeah,
would you say that the only person like that who came in either for a show or for an appearance who got like negative reaction would have been Jeff Hardy?
Jeff Hardy, yeah, definitely got booed out of the building.
Wouldn't you think he was like really the only one who's ever like come like you know who they?
I think Conan when he really got blown up in Philadelphia.
Yeah, okay. But I think a lot of the fans recognize that was also the guy he was in the ring with. I think most people recognize that, and just knew it wasn't going to be a great match. So
yeah, and I don't know as far as other like big guest stars. Nothing else really comes to mind. What's his name? Daniel.
Oh, Pewter. Daniel Pewter.
Pewter got booed out of the building. But yeah, I don't know if that was. Yeah, I don't know if that was more of a we hate you because you're a WWE guy, or we hate you because you're a dick, or we hate you because you're a UFC or MMA guy, or just a combination of all those things. But yeah, they did not want Daniel Pewter on that night.
Trust me, they made the right decision.
Yeah. No.
No. I would rather watch Joe and Morishima try to do an MMA fight than Daniel Puder do anything.
Absolutely.
Yes, GST, thoughts on Morishima or San Martino?
I thought the segment was great. Obviously, it just shows the history of New York and the respect the Ring of Honor had for it. The foreshadowing of seeing Joe and Morishima, and later on, obviously, Morishima would, I believe he was champion for only 8 months, but still just very similar mold as Joe. And I thought this, I kind of thought like Mikio, because I remember when I was first watching it, that it would have led to like an impromptu match or something. Maybe not just an official match, but at least something a little bit longer. But we eventually got it. But man, that would have been pretty great to see them just go at it right then and there. But good stuff. It was good.
All right, next up is Adam Pearce versus Delirious in a battle of future Ring of Honor members with a special stipulation we did not know at the time, which is the winner of the match becomes the booker first. And Pearce was doing Commissioner Cornette's bidding at this time, a few years back before both men would gain booking power. And this is also before the Hangman 3 angle, which we don't have to get into detail about. Of note, in this match early on, Delirious tricks Pearce by running under the ring. And comes out, does a running cannonball off the apron, and then he chops Pierce right near PW Insider's own Stuart Carapola, who is a, or Carapola. I always never know how to pronounce his last name, but he was a good buddy of ours at the time and still is, and of course GLF. Then it's a decent 8 to 10 minute fight, basically goes back and forth. Pierce gets a nice spine buster, uses some more power on old school offense to take over on Delirious. Delirious gets a warrior, Ultimate Warrior influenced comeback clotheslines, and then followed by 60 never ending story clotheslines in the corner. So very impressive there. Gets his big moves, the flying drop kick, the panic attack, the shadows. The hell, but Shane Hagedorn is out and blasts him with loaded knuckles on the top rope. Slides under the ring, just gets the piledriver, three count, gets to be the booker first after Gabe Sapolsky, and Delirious will have to wait the turn. And
Was
then
that actually the
Pearson,
stipulation for the match? I don't remember.
I don't think it was, but it should have been. It really should have been because that's the way it turned out. Pearce introduces Hagedorn as his new assistant to pretty good heat, and he refers to him as his personal manservant and gives out some free hugs. Just a shame, though. Mikio, thoughts on Delirious versus Adam Pearce?
It's amazing. I going back and watching it again. It really shook me to re remember how much the fans were really into the whole thing that the whole act that Delirious was doing.
Yeah.
I mean, they were he was just like the crowd was just so hot for him, and it continued for a while too. And it's like on some levels it was just so stupid. The act was just so stupid. But at the same time, it was just so much fun. You couldn't not get into it.
Yeah, I think he felt like I think Pierce threw him right over near us, and I end up giving him a giant pep talk where I think you could hear me just say "bah bah bah" about a million different times.
And the thing with the other thing that I kind of thought about when I was watching this, Pierce's old school kind of old school old style heel routine that he was doing at the time was so different than everything that or that anybody else in ROH was doing. And it's like I always really appreciated it because it was so different. It was just like this really kind of very traditional, yelling at the old lady in the front row kind of bullshit. And I don't know that I there's Adam Pearce did it great. He was awesome in that role.
I don't think a lot of Ring of Honor fans appreciated that.
Yeah,
That that's just based off of, seeing people when they post about the past of Ring of Honor and they talk about Adam Pearce being a talent, they generally go, "Oh, he wasn't that good." And it's like, well, if you're going to compare him to the different styles that Ring of Honor had, maybe he's the more laid, relaxed style. But that's the heel. That is the classic heel,
Right.
and that's what he was trying to do. That's the point. And I
Yeah,
think
right.
sometimes it goes over people's head. I don't know why, but
I
it
don't either.
does.
It's like because he was a heat magnet too. I mean, it's just like, he would be constantly talking to the fans, during a match and saying like all sorts of the most obnoxious shit that he could think of. And it's like he was riling the crowd up, but then people would be like, "Well, he's really not the right kind of guy for ROH." It's like, Yeah, he is, because he's not like everybody else.
Yeah, I kind of thought the match was that point. And I you look back at it and think of, you have two former Ring of Honor bookers, and then you had Cornette, and Delirious, one of the silliest characters in Ring of Honor history. I mean, he was just kind of the... he could fit into anything. If you needed something serious, he would shift into Red Delirious and be serious. If you needed some comedy relief, he could do that too. And he's just a perfect example of how to take a character like that and make the fans take him seriously, which is something that I think now a lot of fans kind of criticize Cornette and Delirious kind of himself now for his booking, that there's a way to do it, and this was that way. You made Delirious seem serious as a contender. And that's why when later on when he would get title shots, even though you kind of thought, oh, he wouldn't win, but it was, he was still credible to a certain degree. So I thought this match kind of had that.
All right, so next up is Jacobs with Lacey versus Christopher Daniels versus Okabana in a triple threat match. The winner gets to strip Lacey. I don't know if that's true or not.
Jacobs, the stipulation of the match?
Yeah, well, maybe we should have been involved if we had known that, but too late now. Jacobs out to the Ballad of Lacey song, purple lighting and cell phone waving. And this is really cool. Again, one of the things about being in the Hammerstein is you can start to really see that these visual, like the visual production was getting some cool and interesting stuff and showing what Ring of Honor was capable of creating when they put their mind to it at this point in the promotion's history. And there's definitely some work going into making the entrances special. And it's something I hadn't picked up on back then. Daniels has his epic introduction at, you know, with the big crescendo, and then lots of people banging on the guardrails and going crazy for him. So basically, the story of this match is Jacobs is devastated and sullen at the beginning. He's dragging on the ropes. He doesn't want to wrestle. He's crying, and he's forcing Daniels and Cabana to wrestle on their own because he doesn't want to participate. And Daniels is sort of just caught in the middle of it all, just doing the best that he can. Jacob still follows Lacey's orders, though, and when she tells him to get aggressive, he gets aggressive. He turns it into essentially a handicap match, and Lacey wants him to help Cabana throughout the match. And Cabana does some comedy here, cleverly copying a feel, and gets a look under the skirt under the guise of strategy. Mm-hmm. Match follows pretty much along that way with some cute and clever wrestling built around that. And I think basically Cabana tries the best that he can to befriend Jacobs, but it ends up inadvertently becoming this old, like, Charlie Brown, Lucy in the Football gag. And Daniel's body is the football. And Jacobs gets to return the favor a little bit later as Daniel sidesteps a Jacobs spear and it gets Cabana. Jacobs then low blows Cabana and gets the contra code, clearing out Daniels for the win. So Jacobs has finally won for Lacey, but Lacey is furious and more concerned with Colt's lower nutsack region, as Prazak calls it, quote unquote. And Jacobs instructs or dares Cabana to use those balls now, quote unquote. So kind of a clever match, I thought, and nothing too high risk as far as in the ring goes, but some fun stuff. So GST, let's start with the thoughts on the triangle match there, and I don't know, the lower nutsack region of Colt Cabana.
Well, I don't know too much about that, but the match itself was meh. I mean, the only real reason, it's just to further the Jacobs Cabana angle. That's pretty much all it was. In terms of the quality of it, I when I watched it, you know, at first you see the three talents involved and you're like, oh, this is going to be excellent. And it's like, eh, not so much. But I mean, obviously it was to bring out what was going on between Cabana and Lacey and Jacobs. So for that, it was great. But for the match itself, I could live without it. So not too much there.
Mikio, you were there live, so your thoughts on live perspective or watching it back?
Okay. Now, I was not actually there for this match, if you remember correctly. I had stepped out at this point.
You got to stop doing that, Mikio.
Well, the thing is, I was still coaching football at the time, and we had played a game that afternoon, And one of our players had gotten really badly hurt during the game. And
oh,
I got a call.
I remember that, yeah.
I got a call right before that match started from my other one of my the coaches I worked with, who was at the hospital with the kid. And he was giving me the injury heads up, if you will. And so I didn't really see most of the match live. So I was, you know, just taking that phone call at that point. And if you actually do watch the, you know, you see on the DVD, when I do come back, you see I have a real long face, because we found out that the kid we thought was our star player at that point was going to be out for the rest of the season. So that
oh,
was
wait,
kind of
wasn't
like,
this the kid's name Eddie Guerrero, or was that
somebody
no,
else? No. This was the kid Dusap, and he wound up breaking he broke the humerus in his arm, and he was it was pretty nasty. I have the video somewhere around here, yeah, so we figured we were like, because I remember, and Ari probably remembers it, when I got to the show that night, I was in a really awful mood, because
actually, I don't remember.
We had
that evening, other than
we,
it was awesome.
We choked in overtime. It was like, you know, because the high school rules play like college rules in overtime, and we had the ball down inside like the 2-yard line, and we just couldn't punch it home, and we were a power running team, and it was just like, you know, I was the offensive line coach, so I felt like absolute crap that my guys couldn't move the ball 2 fucking yards and get us a touchdown, excuse my French. But I remember that bus ride home from that game. It was an away game in the Bronx, and we, you know, being from Brooklyn, it's a schlep and a half. And I remember the head coach of the team sitting across from me on the bus and just telling, we're not going to win another game this year. Long story short, turned out to be the best year we ever had. When I was coaching, because everybody else on the team stepped up, and it was awesome. So, but as far as that match, you know, the funny thing is that Chris said, you know, he said that the match was kind of like meh. I actually wrote that down when I was taking my notes for when I was watching the DVD. I actually have it written here. Match is meh, and it was like, it's true. It really was. It was like. And you would have expected so much more from the three guys in it, but Jacobs was doing the whole sad Jimmy thing, and it was just like, oh, come on. And, you know, Ari probably remembers that at this point I was like, I hated the Jimmy Jacobs shit at this point.
Yeah.
I hated it.
We talked about that last time, too. Yeah.
And, you know, it was like, you know, but, you know, seeing Chris, you know, seeing Daniels, you know, working the match, and, you know, Chris, I think if you want to see the best of what he's capable of, the only place to look at is the ROH stuff. You look at, you know, he's done some good stuff in TNA, but he's never, it's like his ROH stuff is always kind of like, you know, head and shoulders above anything else I've seen him do. And,
He's done it in different eras, too. I mean, you've got this era, and then you've got the 2010 comeback, and each time, like, he's really good in the ring.
Right. I mean, it's like, it's just like, it's almost like he's just like, he feels like he can cut loose and do whatever he feels is comfortable with at that time in his life to kind of do in the ring. And it's like, you always see something really good from him in an ROH match. So it was great. It was kind of good to see that he got his stuff in and whatever, but you know, the whole thing with Lacey and she, you know, I said heat magnet before with Pierce, she was a huge heat magnet.
I always kind of thought that Daniels during this time could have not maybe had a world title run, but would have had a feud with Danielson. But I always kind of felt that Ring of Honor was wary that TNA would pull him completely out. So they never gave him a, you know what I mean? A really serious feud, which I thought he should have had, but I understood TNA's right there on the edge, so you can't put him in something too important because he could get taken out at any moment.
Yeah.
All right, so lesson learned, the Mikios football team was better than this match.
And it was better. Yes, it was better.
Yes, that season anyway. So let's talk about next up.
Might have been better than this next segment also, just saying.
Well, we'll talk about that. This is a pretty big segment for one Jim Cornette, but this is basically the start of Samoa Joe and Homicide with Julius Smokes in a bulletproof vest, like he's part of the Shield, up against the Briscoe brothers. But before that, he was still the authority here at that, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, he was the commissioner. That's their word. Commissioner. Yes.
There you go. Commissioner Cornette. Yeah, he's out there first. The New York City crowd actually pretty much. It was interesting because they started out kind of half supporting him, and then, you know, when he turned on New York City, that's when the boos really come out. And here, I mean, just again, the mixed reaction. The Midnight Express music gets a pop, but then Skinner comes out and gets boos. I don't know. I figure. We get clips of the Death Before Dishonor 4 Cage of Death aftermath, where Cornette of homicide after the match, and their immediate chance for homicide. By the New York City audience, hugely over at this point in New York City. Cornette cuts quite the promo, and he mentions the word homicide, and that becomes sort of a derogatory remark towards homicide at this point, in this era, Ring of Honor. And he doesn't have a problem with anyone except anyone who takes homicide's side, with me or against me, basically. And he surveys the crowd, and there's a majority of people against him. Survey says another one for the bad guys. And that leads to New York City. He basically trashes them in grand fashion, talks about, you know, all the bad things that are involved in New York City, and basically ends his speech with the quote, "Lynyrd Skynyrd lives, stars and bars, the Confederacy, the great state of Kentucky, they rule, and New York, you blow, so blow away." So, yeah, Homicide is, like, hugely over after that. And basically, if Homicide wins this match, this tag match against the Briscoes, then he'll get his final battle title shot in December 2006. If not, he'll get it in 2007. But, oh, wait. Homicide promised he would leave Ring of Honor if he didn't win the title by the end of 2006. And that would be impossible because he'd be gone. Strategy. So, as far as the match itself, it's a solid, okay-ish brawl. You know what? I thought it was actually, you know, what the Briscoes get hacked for during this time is not selling enough. There's too many kind of comebacks here and there where it's like they're getting beat on, then they'll come back and won't sell it. Then they'll quickly, you know, somebody will come back on them. And I think that was this match. It got repeated a lot too many times. But the big things are Joe and Homicide doing dives at the beginning, and then their tag team move comebacks at the end. I also thought Julius was very entertaining, telling one of the Briscoes, I think, after a Homicide dropkick, "You just got knocked the fuck out." That was entertaining. Loved that. Basically, the finish of the match runs down to a suplex clothesline combo. Joe catches a Doomsday Device springboard attempt, and it looked gross with this twerk on Mark's knee. That was GSE.
Okay, so my thoughts on this were, I actually thought it was a pretty good match. I mean, it was what you would expect, these four guys brawling, but I think that's what the crowd really wanted at this moment. And Homicide, obviously, he's over in New York, right? I mean, that's just how this works. And, of course, the mentioning of Low-Key, I'll always give my hopes up. Someday, Ari, he'll return. Someday. Maybe this year. Who knows? But the Briscoes, obviously, big time heels at this moment, and I think that really fit them. I mean, I've always thought they were better as heels, and this them beating up on Joe, who they have a storied history with as well, it kind of made sense. It's funny how you had Joe and Homicide though come together because of their past, but you know, it all kind of comes together at the end, and Joe helps Homicide win, and Homicide's feuding with Cornette, the establishment, so to speak, and pretty similar to what he's doing now, I guess. And I don't know. I thought the match was better than okay. I thought it was pretty good. And I guess if there was anything to say that it was weird about it was the Briscoes. You know, like you said, they were always kind of criticized for not selling, kind of similar to how the American Wolves were criticized for a long time. But you know what? That kind of fits them because they are the badass heels. You're going to beat on them, but they're not going to sell it. They're not going to tell you, oh, I'm hurt. They're just going to come back and beat you up. That was kind of the thing people liked about them in a weird way, especially the New York crowd, which is why I think the Briscoes have always been popular there. Other than that, I thought the match was good and a really good way to go into intermission.
I agree. You know, with the New York City crowd, they really like, you know, they really like Joe. They really like Homicide, so you give them that going into mission, then you're going to get a pretty happy crowd. Mikio, thoughts on Cornette and what he said at the time, and also this match.
Oh, I mean the you know what he well, you know what he said in the promo was, you know, obviously just a storyline point to kind of get to the situation with Homicide. The thing is that I never really fully understood why they never kind of went in this direction is that when you have these two guys who are playing heels and wearing trunks that are the Confederate flag, why aren't you – they never played it up, as far as I was concerned, enough to get the real heat you could have gotten off of them being, you know, these redneck, you know, Confederate kind of guys. You know what I mean? And it was just like –
yeah,
you know, having them partnered up with Cornette and him saying all like, you know, basically doing like the South is going to rise again promo, which is basically what he did. You know, it's like I never understood why they didn't play more of the angle with that. The match itself, you know, it was four really good hands in a really decent match. And it was, you know, you knew what you were going to get when you saw those four guys were going to be in the match together. So it didn't surprise me in any way as far as like the quality of the match was concerned. But It was just one of those things that I always thought that they kind of left there on the table, that they never really, you know, took advantage of or explored in the idea of really going with that whole,
Mickey,
you know.
I think, to be fair, we've seen some of Jay's, shall we say, Southern tendencies get him into a lot of trouble now. So.
Yeah, but that's like now. It's like when they were first doing that with putting them in the Confederate shorts or letting them wear the Confederate shorts, you know, at the time they didn't explore it at all. They just kind of like, well, they're from Delaware, blah, blah, blah. That would have been the perfect time to go somewhere with that.
I kind of always felt that they were trying to give it that Freebirds feel, where these were guys are just from the South, they like to fight, and you know that, but they're beating up guys you like. So
That's my thing. I don't know if that's part of it, but I always got that feel that the Briscoes were the Freebirds of Ring of Honor.
Okay, fair enough.
And just to restate the finish of the match, I think that might have cut out. GST was telling me off air that Homicide wins with the Cop Killer. So essentially, he guarantees a title shot in New York City. And yeah, I mean, it would have been interesting to see the Briscoes get more involved, you know, kind of rethinking the final battle 2006 finish with Danielson. You know, Pierce was there to interfere. Briscoes, not really so much at that point. But yeah, it's a story for another time. Intermission time with Gary Michael Capetto. Words from Lacey and Cabana in obvious pain after being hit in the balls. And Jacobs comes in and is exuberant over his win. And Lacey is not happy about that at all. She forces him to apologize for winning with a low blow. Cabana wants a massage. Lower, lower, lower. And she kicks out both Jacobs and Gary Michael Capetta. So, use your interpretation. Backstage with Bruno Sammartino, Mara Fuji, and Brian Danielson, or Daniel Bryan. Sammartino gives words of advice to Danielson, and he talks about the responsibility of defending the Ring of Honor World title and the GHC title, which Mara Fuji had at the time. And I thought this was really cool. Just again, putting Sammartino putting over both guys as champions, and that's something that's pretty invaluable. If you got him on your show and you can do that, and do something like this, then you do it. So not much else to say about those segments. Let's get to the second half. Ring of Honor World Tag Team Title Match. Generation Next are the champions: Austin Aries and Roderick Strong versus the Kings of Wrestling, Claudio Castagnoli and Chris Hero, and Kings of Wrestling come out to Queens, We Are the Champions, and symbolize their being, I think they were CZW and Chikara tag team champions at the time as well, and to throw down the gauntlet to Generation X that they were about to take the Ring of Honor belts as well. And quite the, again, you know, when they can use real songs like this to make a statement, and it just adds to the atmosphere that much. And Claudio, or Antonio as he's better known these days, he just looks so... I don't know. Swank? Is that word I can use in that gear? He's got like a glittery jacket with all the trimmings and
no,
the
that
facial
ring gear
hair.
Was awful. That ring gear was awful. Sorry. It was awful.
Come on, Chris.
It was awful.
Well, they combined that with his mustache and the facial hair. Let me tell you. Maybe I just like awful fashion. So what can you do? Austin Aries has his ribs taped, his midsection. It's like he lost a toilet paper wrapping contest or something, because these are some very taped up ribs. In fact, it's like his entire stomach. Maybe he's getting lessons from DDP or something. And again, interesting, it's a bit of a split crowd. Aries and Strong are very over in New York City, but Kings of Wrestling, they certainly have a sizable fan base there as well. And they're still outsiders, but you know, you could, they're still over because they were over on the independent scene at that time. So there's some good opening stuff with things going wrong for Hero, Gasnierly, and Strong. Roger Strong is able to capitalize it and hit some pretty searing chops there. And they get the Austin Aries and Strong get the dumb heart attack. The heat comes when Hero basically attacks the ribs. He knocks Aries off onto the, you know, off the ropes, rib first, and that becomes a target throughout the match. There's some innovative Kings of Wrestling tag moves that would become their tradition during this stretch run of theirs. Some like the dropkick to the ribs and the gutbuster combo, the boot boot ripcord release. Strong gets a great comeback. Aries gets a great comeback with his big moves like the running dropkick and then the heat-seeking missile. Double tope onto both Kings of Wrestling. And I thought the my favorite moment is when Aries does the running dropkick and then Strong gets his sick kick back-to-back. I really love that moment. But even though Gen X seems to have it in hand, Hero and Strong, they knock Aries off and basically, that is the beginning of the end. Claudio gets a briefcase. The briefcase he carried to the ring at that point. I'm not even sure what was in the briefcase. Was it money?
Yeah, because he was from the United Banks of Switzerland.
And Swiss Money Holding. That's right. That's right. So Claudio hits him square in the ribs with the briefcase, knocking him off the ropes. Basically, there's a double team Hero's Welcome on Strong that sends him out. Aries gets one final volley, but he just doesn't have it in him, and Kings of Wrestling unleash KRS-One and throw him up in the air, bring him down with a powerbomb, and Claudio covers Aries for the win. We have new tag team champions, and again, fun to hear the mixed reaction from the New York City crowd. There's some bullshit chants. There's some King of Wrestling, shut the fuck up chants. They embrace and they walk out, and Claudio finds his briefcase again and does this great ooh face outside the ring, like, oh, don't tell anyone, as he picks it up. I know Chris Micchio here was fucking elated as Hero and Claudio walk over to our side of the barricade and out of the building and just supporting them. And then also just quick note that Strong was helped out by Rhett Titus, then Stoll student. And Strong and Rhett Titus helped carry Aries out to the back, is what my notes have here. So, Micchio, were you fucking elated as the Kings of Wrestling won
$50? I was overjoyed. I was a huge fan of the Kings of Wrestling at that point. You know, with their work in Chikara, their work in CZW, the whole CZW ROH feud, where we really kind of got, you know, the chance to really see them together at least a little bit. I was even more excited when I was actually used as a handle by Chris Hero to climb over the barricade. As he propped himself up on my shoulder as he left right next to us.
I remember
Ari, you were bent. You were not a happy puppy about the outcome of that match.
Oh yeah, and, I was pretty curious.
I was one of the people leading the Kings of Wrestling chant that night, so I was more than satisfied to see them take the title. I remember the one thing that I remember is when they came out with the Campeones de Parejas belts. ROH crowd always used to chant plastic belts at them because they really did. They were some of the most plastic looking titles I'd ever seen in my life. But you know, it was the match was excellent, but you know, once again, you know, when you put guys who are really good into a setting where they're given the opportunity to kind of take the ball and run with it, that's what you're going to get. It was great. I really enjoyed that night. I love the fact that they came out through the general admit area up on the stage, and then they left, like, you know, not through the back like everybody else does, but they left out like through the crowd, which was kind of a cool touch as them being the outsiders. The whole thing with like in the commentary, they're talking about how, you know, like Chris Hero versus like ROH, that he's obsessed with ROH, that it's the, you know, he never, even though he's like been given all these opportunities to go away, he just won't because he can't let go of the ROH thing. And I thought that was a really good angle. So I really enjoyed the match, and you know, I've always been a huge fan of like both those guys, both Hero and Castagnoli.
And now Hero is back in Ring of Honor, so it's really funny how again how prescient things can become when looking back at them, because now he's back, and you know, he's never really was the most beloved guy in Ring of Honor. I think a lot of, you know, guys like
appreciated
Joe,
but not beloved.
Yeah, and I think it should be interesting to see what happens now if that becomes sort of like his role, where like he becomes super over because people like really want him there and really love him and appreciate him there. But I guess we'll see. GST, yep. Thoughts on the tag title switch? Because I know you and I also at this time were talking a lot about Gen X and the tag team titles, and really into them revitalizing the tag team scene at the time.
Yeah, I mean, they had what, 9 months as tag champions? That's just something Ring of Honor was well known for, where their champions were very seriously taken. And you know, this is kind of that style of booking that was missing at the time. So it was really great to see Ring of Honor do it. I think that while this was, a very good match, the Kings of Wrestling, you know, as you said, Mikio, were still during their stints between CZW and Chikara. And sometimes they would bring that to Ring of Honor. And that, for me, was not what I was looking for. The second run of the Kings of Wrestling and Ring of Honor is what I expected. You know, they were a little bit more serious, not necessarily, you know, I can understand antics, you know, and kind of fleshing out their characters, but they did some of this, you know, that funny comedy stuff in Ring of Honor that it works in Chikara, it kind of worked in CZW, but when I'm watching Ring of Honor, I don't want to see it. And I think that's probably what some of the fans didn't appreciate at the time, because as you guys have both stated, as New York Ring of Honor fans, you wanted to see a pretty serious product. And these guys maybe gave too little of that, especially when they are going to be the new tag champions and that's what you wanted out of them. Granted, I thought it was a perfect time for the titles to be switched. Aries and Strong, 9 months in, didn't really feel there was a whole lot more that they could have done without having another serious feud, and I think this was it for them. So the Kings of Wrestling came at a good time, but I think that there was something about them that just wasn't there at the time. And obviously, you know, this was what, 2006. So
yeah.
They hadn't really fleshed it out. When they came back the second time as the Kings of Wrestling, they really had it down. So, but still, I thought a really good match. And, you know, that KRS-One, you don't see very many teams doing moves like that anymore. And when I saw it, I was like, man, that's so impressive still to this day.
Yeah. You don't see a lot of, you know, even with, you know, you don't see too many great tag team moves like that anymore.
I think a lot of it is that move. A lot of it's incumbent on the guy to, you know, kind of tuck his back properly and get the neck right. It can be a little bit risky, I think, but you know, it's certainly, you know, it made an impression, because I think that was the first time they did that move and everyone was just like going, wow, what the hell was that? You know, that was pretty lethal from the first moment you saw it. You knew, well, that was the end right there. Okay, so BJ Whitmer promo. His foot is taped up. He's basically talking about Jimmy Jacobs and how he didn't get the job done in their feud. Doctors tell him he can't come back for another 12 to 16 weeks, and he promises to come back and repay Jacobs for every second of the physical therapy he's got to go through. BJ Whitmer basically showing some of the clips that, you know, him and Jacobs went through, including the powerbomb in Detroit, which is a horror show, and at the New Yorker, which again, Chris and I were at that show and saw the, you know, basically the powerbomb that was delivered into the crowd. Some really crazy stuff, but it's BJ Whitmer, so what do you expect? And then we got the GHC heavyweight title match with Naomichi Arafuji defending against Nigel McGuinness. And this is basically about a month after Nigel had lost the Pure title. And because of his effort throughout the summer, I think he was really becoming a de facto babyface because of the fact that people liked the work he was doing, and they had seen the unified title match, and really were impressed by him. Marufuji, basically, this is a week after him winning the GHC title from Jun Akiyama at Budokan Hall. So I don't want to say that anyone really thought Nigel could win here, but, you know, maybe 99.9% really didn't think Nigel would win. But it's still, this match is about showcasing both of the guys' talents and their wrestling abilities and wowing the crowd with some cool stuff. It wasn't, that said, it wasn't a fast-paced match. It was a little bit more of a deliberate style match, but, you know, the crowd really gets into it by the end and for a lot of these big moves. You know, the Tower of London off the apron, these big kick volleys that Marufuji does. We get a lot of the trimmings of the GHC, the pro wrestling Noah type style stuff, like the music introduces it. We get an introduction read by Bobby Cruz, and so that sort of made things a little bit special here. Whereas it might, without the kind of stuff, it might just have been a good solid three and a half star match where both guys gave a lot of effort. You know, they did some really cool stuff, but I think it was the atmosphere that really helped kick things up. Some of the big memorable moves towards the finish of the match, including a count out tease after the Shiranui using the turnbuckles outside for momentum. That was kind of crazy. Nigel gets a lot of his clotheslines. He was starting to use that strong style a lot more, the big clotheslines, the rebound clothesline. And I think that's what really kicked the fans into the gear. Marufuji no-sells a Tower of London, which looked crazy, but he uses that fighting spirit to get the Shiranui again. There is a coast-to-coast dropkick that he uses, and a super Shiranui for the three count. Huge chance for both, a hug and embrace from both. I think Marufuji really gave McGuinness a lot, especially in the beginning and middle of the match, and helped him get it over even in a loss. So, GST, thoughts on seeing Marufuji versus McGuinness here? Do you think it helped McGuinness get to that that next level as he was prepping to take that next level we talked about earlier to the Ring of Honor World title?
I think so. I think you worded it perfectly in that after the summer and some of the losses, Nigel, he was really building up some legitimacy in the ring when it came to the fans. But since he technically he was losing, and you're not really going to get behind a guy that loses. But in this sense, the GHC title, a ton of prestige to it, especially from Marufuji, who we wanted from. And of course, Marufuji just coming over was special enough. And then what they read before their title matches is great. They get their own entrance music. It really makes the title mean a lot. And as you said, it was basically a Van Terminator and then the Super Shiranui, which defeated McGuinness. And you couldn't blame, that's just there's no one that's going to kick out of that. And if he had, I think some fans would have even disliked it a little bit because it's like, come on. So the match itself, I think, made McGuinness, and even in the loss, and he looked stronger going out. Marufuji, of course, always special when he came over to Ring of Honor. Any of the Noah guys when they came over was always special. So I think this really was a well-built match. I don't know. It was that moment of because after this didn't some of the Noah guys stopped coming over, but Kenta kept coming over and Marufuji kept coming over. So it was almost like they were part of the roster to a degree. And
yeah, it really felt that way at a point in that era.
Exactly. You were like Marufuji and Kenta. Yeah, they're pretty much Ring of Honor guys.
Exactly. So. It was like they went from being attractions to being like expectations. That you expected to see them in a show. If you'd seen they were always at the New York shows. And it was like, it's like if they weren't on a New York show, it was kind of like, hey, wait a minute. Why aren't those guys here tonight?
Yeah, I think it was pretty I'm sure you guys must have been loving seeing this match live.
Because we
I believe this was the first time also, correct? This was the first time the GHC title was defended in Ring of Honor. So I
correct.
Think it's just
yes,
double special.
Yes, that's true. And on American soil at all, I believe, was the whole hook for it. And it literally happened, because, again, he won the title a week earlier. And, they sort of just went with it. Mikio, I don't think we got your thoughts on the match itself, so feel free.
I thought, like Chris said, it was the kind of match where even though McGuinness, wound up losing, his standing in ROH, not just with the crowd, but in the general idea of what was going on, he was so elevated as a result of that match, and it was really great. And it's like I remember and the environment in the arena and the feeling in the crowd that night was just so wicked that it was just like it made the match feel like one of the most important matches you'll ever see. And ROH had always saved their a lot of that big special feeling kind of stuff for New York. And we'd seen, you know, like after seeing Joe Kobashi, you figured, wow, it couldn't get more special than that. And then to have that, you know, that kind of match after that, it was like, oh my God, how do these guys keep doing it?
And then to follow that up with the main event.
Yeah. And it was like, you go back and it's like, you know, it was like Chris said, it was a very deliberate kind of match. But everything was really stiff. Everything, all the technique was like ridiculous. You really couldn't have asked for more, from two guys in that match. That was just ridiculously good. And, you know, the Shiranui from the apron to the floor was awesome. The Tower of London from the turnbuckle to the outside to the apron was great. It's like, it was just so spot on. It gave you everything you really needed to see. And it's like, you kind of think about it. It's like, if you were going to show somebody, you know, a match who had not seen ROH at that point, that might have been one of those type of, like, you know, defining matches that you would have shown and said, this is what we get when we go to the show. This is why we pay to see the show.
Yeah, I mean, it built up. I mean, I really think the pace was even all the way through about halfway through the match, and then really kind of picked up with a lot of the big moves. And that's sort of the way it works in both the New Japan Pro Wrestling Noah style and then the Ring of Honor style that they'd basically been using for the big shows, the big main events at that time.
The other thing that I noticed when I watched it is, like, you know, and we've talked about this a lot, you know, between ourselves, you and I, Ari, that, you know, a lot of the times one of the biggest issues with ROH matches is sometimes they just felt too long, and sometimes they felt like they were just long to be long. You know, this match, even though it was a longer match, it never felt long because of the pacing of the match. And it was just like, you know, it had that steady build, and it, you know, the intensity just kept ratcheting up, you know, slightly every few minutes, and it didn't feel the same, but it was just as good, if not better, than some of those, you know, 40-minute matches that you had seen.
And definitely, it's like that and the tag title match, and even the main event. It's like you said what you said those match, you played the notes, and then you were done. You know, like you knew where to get out on the KRS one. You knew that was it. The Super Shiranui, you knew that was it. So there were definitely.
That's what happens when you put guys into a position to succeed. I mean, these were all guys put into matches with other guys who you knew they could do great things with. And I think that's one of the problems that you see with wrestling promotions, not just ROH or with anybody, is that you can't expect to polish a turd. You know, if you have guys who are just not, they don't have chemistry, they're never going to give you a good match. But if you put guys who have chemistry into the right space and the right time, you'll get a night of matches like you saw with this show.
And speaking of right match at the right time, that takes us to the main event, the Ring of Honor World title, Bryan Danielson, or whatever, defending the title against Kenta.
You know who we're talking about.
Yeah, come on now. Kenta is accompanied by Davey Richards, as was said before. He's under apprenticeship to Kenta at this time. And the big thing about this match, again, going into it, it had the subtext of Danielson's title run going into the one-year mark and the anniversary mark, that also having the shoulder injury made it really like I bought into the fact that, oh, well, Danielson's going to lose here. And also the fact is, as Mikio mentioned in the beginning of this podcast, that Kenta had been signed to a whole bunch of dates in November and December of that year, and it was basically said that if Kenta won the title, he'd come back and defend the title. So you bought into the, you know, basically what they did end up doing with Morishima, but a year later is essentially what happened here. You could have thought would have happened, and I was totally into that. I was like, oh, wow, man, Danielson may need some time off, and they may need to transition the belt here. And so all that stuff, I think a lot of people knew that too. And so everything that was done to build up the match, the working on the arm and the shoulders that happened throughout the match really got you to the point where you believed in every near fall and near submission. And really what I think helps catapult this match into one of the best matches of Ring of Honor's entire history. I mean, I gave it 5 stars and I gave it my match of the year when I did Call of Honor. And looking back on it, I still hold to that. I think as far as a technical wrestling match with great action and the drama of, you know, Danielson could realistically lose the title at this point, you know, you're talking about right match, right time, right crowd, and it all kind of came together. So just quickly, I won't go through the entire play-by-play. I'd like to leave a little bit of something to Mikio and GST, but essentially the match starts with a code of honor and this begrudging respect between the two, but you could also see the intensity between the two, the hatred. And so whenever it becomes technical, but whenever it's, you know, about going for the shoulder or when Kenta disrespects Danielson, Danielson disrespects Kenta, then it's on. And, you know, there's some losing of tempers and hitting each other hard and tempers flaring, and the crowd loves that. And so it really, the match, the atmosphere derives from that. In a famous sequence, Kenta kicks the crap out of Danielson right in front of Mikio and I, like a little girl, get out of the way, even though I'm in no danger of being hit. So that moment is a part of so many different video packages and shit like that, and I get so embarrassed. But I'm glad nobody really knows, you know. But now they do. It's out in the open. There's a slap Kenta gives to Danielson after blocking a sunset flip. That the sound of it is fucking insane, and it echoes throughout the entire building. All the kicks to the shoulder, knowing what Danielson is going through, are crazy, and they're sold like $1 million. Danielson heals it up on Kenta, and it's funny because the crowd likes Danielson, but they also don't like him healing it up. So whenever he goes, like some cheating, like an eye rake on the ropes, or he holds the ropes in the figure four, the crowd reacts to that. He uses the chicken crossface chicken wing as a submission move here to build up towards the cattle mutilation, and he used that to win the title against Gibson, so people know that and react to it. The final stretch down is basically, you know, Kenta work Fujiwara armbar, and it works because, one, it's Ring of Honor, and that kind of stuff always works in Ring of Honor, and two, he worked on the arm the whole time. And Danielson jumps right into an ace crusher and back into a Fujiwara armbar late in the match, and it's amazing that the fans bit on that so well because they knew the arm and the shoulder were the weak points. Danielson comes back, and he does what he does best, which is he strings all these big moves, goes right into the cattle mutilation, and that's always fun to see how he can connect them all together. Kenta catches Danielson off the ropes at one point and hits the go to sleep. It's a three count, but Danielson gets his foot on the ropes at the last split second, so the match continues. The Musaiku knee kick to the back, tries it again with super speed, but Danielson sidesteps it. An O'Connor roll with a bridge for a very close count. And the go to sleep is counted into a crucifix, but Danielson turns it into the MMA elbows. Kenta takes them even though he's trapped and powers up. A whole bunch of cattle mutilation attempts and reversals. And finally, Danielson has it on again, and Kenta is forced to tap. There are best in the world chants for Danielson, had to retain the title. Kenta chants, essentially an epic title fight. I loved it. It had everything I want in a Ring of Honor match in it. And I will watch this match no matter what time of day it is, no matter what time of year it is. I will keep going back to this match to watch and enjoy it. It's one of Danielson's best. And if you're a fan of Daniel Bryan and WWE, I think it's sort of almost mandatory. You kind of got to go back in history and search this match out. Let's go to Mikio first. Okay, man. So your live reactions being right there next to me and not running away from Kenta's kicks.
I got, of all the matches I've seen live, I would definitely put this one in my top five.
I think I might agree with that.
The atmosphere, the buzz in the crowd, it was unbelievable that night. When we were talking about before with the idea that Kenta was going to be booked in the majority of ROH shows for the rest of the year, that year, you really did feel like he could legitimately take the title that night. I always thought that he would be the guy. I always thought that he would be the Noah visitor who would take the title. I never would have. If you would ask me if it would have been Morishima, I would have laughed in your face. I would have definitely thought it would have been, you know, either Kenta or Marufuji, just because they had been around so much, and just because the fact that the crowd was just so into them every time they appeared. It's like you could have had them wrestle like a blow up doll. And, you know, the crowd, the ROH crowd would have just gone nuts for those guys. So, you really did. The threat of a title change that night was legit. I thought the storytelling, like you said, with the working of the arm and doing that, I thought the storytelling was amazing. You know, Kent. The funny thing is that both Kenta and Danielson both had that kind of heelish streak in their personality and their ring persona. That, you know, Kenta would do that, like, you know, that kind of like that that arrogant slap across the face, and then he would also do that one where he like looks like he was like wiping his boots and then like kick a guy with the back of his foot in his face. You know, you'd see that. And then, you know, Danielson was, you know, my favorite thing from the whole night was when the crowd started to kind of get on him. He, you know, like they said, you know, because he had screwed something up or didn't do something 100% right. He yelled at the crowd, "I don't ever fuck up." And it was just like, you know, it was great. I mean, just to see that kind of interplay and the going back and forth between that, you know, just seeing Danielson do the dive from the ropes into the crowd, it will never get old for me. Never. And it's like, if you can see it, at least I remember as clear as a bell, watching my cousin, like I said before, you know, who had never been to an ROH show before, watching him and looking in his face when he was just like, "Oh my God, did that guy actually just do that?" kind of thing. And that was the one thing that he kind of mentioned to me over and over again, you know, like in the weeks and months following it, you know, whenever they came up in conversation, he's like, "I couldn't believe that guy actually made it all that way outside the ring." He's like, "That guy was crazy." And it was just like, you know, that it kind of just did that. The thing is, and you go back and you look at it, and it's like, you think about the diversity of the moves and the holds and the style that you see in that match. It's just like, that's like lightning in a bottle. The brutality in that finish rush that Danielson puts onto Kenta with the elbows and then the submission attempts and the elbows again. It was just so brutal. And, you know, like what the one thing that stuck in my head after watching it was like that match and the one before, like I said before, they really kind of defined what ROH was about in that era. And it's like, I think for people like myself and you, it really kind of set the bar for what we expected or we thought we could see from any promotion that we were watching at that time. And it was just like, it was epic. And I don't really think you can use another word other than epic for that match.
Agreed. And it's essentially, you know, something we see, we can see it in Danielson sometimes, especially like in WWE when he matches up against John Cena, like at SummerSlam. Yeah. But it's not something he does all the time in WWE. And, you know, this was definitely like...
That's an opportunity issue. It's not a matter of talent issue. I think...
Oh, no.
I think,
it's the opportunity. I think, you know, the just fact by that he had the opportunity to do all that.
Right. By seeing what he did with Cena, you know, it's like you would have expected that to open somebody's eyes. And it's like you sit back and you scratch your head. And it's like, what the fuck are they looking at? You know, it's like... It's not like you hired this guy sight unseen. I mean, yeah, you saw what he's capable of. It's like if you could pop 1,000 people or 1,500 people like he did consistently for ROH shows, why wouldn't you think the same shit would fly in front of 15,000? If it's good for 1,000, it's great for 15,000.
It has. I mean, look at the Punk matches from a year or two ago. And I mean, I still think there's something that, like, an epic Punk Bryan match that can be done in a WrestleMania main event. Maybe not this year, but next
Lord,
year.
Good Lord, man.
Danielson can do.
Seeing those two guys, you know, main event to WrestleMania, it would be, I would be happy to stop at that point. It would be like, okay, everything I've watched for the last, you know, X number of years, I'm good now. But I don't think, you know, honestly speaking, I don't think we're going to get it. I don't think we'll ever get it. But that's another story for another day.
Keep hope alive. GST, if you can hear me, go ahead.
Yeah, so...
There we go, we got you.
If anything... that you two have said about the match, I don't think I can top it. To me, this was the epitome of what Ring of Honor fans want out of a main event. Both guys just embodied that strong style that we came to know and love through Ring of Honor. I think that Chris, what you said about Daniel Bryan is just spot on. You know, he was the champion at the time. He's the correct champion for Ring of Honor. And Kenta, damn, you know, he... He's still great to this day. He's still a top talent out of Japan. I think there was something to, like, I think like half of the past few, like, Danielson main events, like his title defenses, not half of all of them, but like, I think it was like out of six had gone 60 minutes. So there was a feeling that he wasn't at 100% also. So that also added to the idea that, man, you could really see Kenta winning it, and it made it believable. And so I kind of wish I could have been in a crowd like that. And I don't know. There's nothing else you can say about this match. Is to me, it's one of the closest things to a perfect wrestling match. And I think anyone that wanted to get into Ring of Honor, it is going to be hard to find. I don't think this DVD is still in circulation. But man, if you, I mean, I know we don't like to
Yeah.
tell people to pirate or anything like that. But if you can find it on YouTube, you really should. Or I think it's on some of the compilations. Is it
It's on the
on?
compilation ones, I think. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, they've released like
Silence.
three. There's
Silence.
three Daniel Bryan compilations, right? That they
Yeah,
released recently. So it's got to be
they
on
also did
one.
they did a Kenta one. I'm just not sure if it's on that or not.
I
That's
think the
right. They did do a Kenta one.
let's do a live on the fly search
Yeah,
here.
I'm
Let's
doing it
go.
right now. I'm
Yeah.
already on it.
Oh. That's the battle is on.
So you
Let's see
can find it first.
Let's see.
Well,
They
one of
just
you could look up Kenta and one could one of because
they actually
they've
just
been
put out.
releasing Daniel Bryan compilations like it's never gonna go out of style. It's
Yeah.
crazy.
Well, they should. I mean, it's like, if you have great material. Actually, here it is. It's on the Bryan Danielson versus the World 2-disc set on ROHWrestling.com right
There
now.
you go.
There you go.
Okay.
Buy that compilation. It's worth it. Just for that match alone.
You have all the Morishima matches on it also. So yeah, it's not like we're here to pimp anybody's operation, but at the same time, if you're a wrestling fan and you don't own the matches that are on this, I mean, I know I own them all because I have all the DVDs, and I know Ari has all the DVDs. If you want to see some great wrestling, this is something to own and to cherish.
Yes. I
I'd
mean,
probably
and
also
the
say
whole.
get the Kenta one also, while you're at it.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I got to say, any kind of complaints I might have about, about some of the things that ROH does, when they put together the compilation things, they put together some pretty good sets.
The artwork has been really top notch too, ever since they started doing the new compilation series. I definitely see that, and just I've never commented on it anywhere, but now I have. I think it's very impressive, and it's a good selling point for people. I mean, I remember you getting the stuff in the original shows and the red boxes with the same pictures over and over again, and then
Oh yeah, and you had to like print up your own like match listings and tape it on the back.
I did that. I did that.
Yep.
Yeah.
So it was funny.
The
It was just
VHSs were the same way. They came in those weird, like white, green, and orange. And I was like, the Ring of Honor colors were black and red. What
right.
is this? What is green and white and
At least
orange?
they
But
got it somewhere right on the DVD box because it's all red.
exactly. Yeah.
All right. Very cool. So I would definitely say, I mean, we've basically been loving this show for the entire 2 hours. I mean, it would be impossible. I think almost universally, people would have to have this as in the top 10, if not top 20 shows of all time. Find this show if you can. If not, try to get the Kenta Danielson match on compilation. And that's pretty much the word, man. I'm glad we got to do this finally. It took a while, but we're back. We'll be doing some more stuff later on as we head into 2014. So I really want to thank GST and Chris Micchio. Let's get some plugs going. Micchio, first of all, what do you got to plug?
I don't plug anything. We love Pro Wrestling Group, Facebook. All three of us are admins on there.
Yes.
Dennis Long, it's Dennis Long's group. He runs a great show. We're always looking for new members, but if you're an idiot, we don't want you. All right. So if you're going to be one of those people who says stupid shit, don't even bother. You'll get the ban hammer really
Hit the
quickly.
bricks, Junior.
Hit the bricks, kid.
Chris
Otherwise,
GST. Yes.
nothing going on over here.
All right, fair enough. Chris GST is the web admin over at Pro Wrestling Ponderings at pwponderings.com. So go ahead, GST, do the website plug.
All right, well, if you're listening to this, we really appreciate it. Hopefully, you're checking it out either on site or on Stitchers slash iTunes. If you are, leave us a review. We'd really appreciate that. 4 or 5 stars helps other listeners find us. Of course, tons of articles. We have a year in review coming very soon, possibly even by the time you hear this, but I won't promise anything. And then, of course, Podcasts of Honor. I have taken over Ring of Honor reviews on PWP as well, so check those out. Send me your feedback. Mailbag at pwponderings.com or CGS Tong, that's CGSTONG at pwponderings is the place to email me.
Very good. And you can catch me on Twitter at Ari Berenstein and on the Podcast of Honor episodes. We're going to try and do one very, very shortly and have that out to you before not too long. So, or I guess it really depends on when this show is released. We might do that before or after the new POH. So whatever, if you were in the past, you might be, you know, listening to it now, do some time traveling of your own and go seek out that the new POH when it comes out. So for GST, for Chris Micchio, we will see you next time when we go back in past, or back in time, to Ring of Honor's past. And we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. Back in time.